Bons assuntos, né?
Hello everyone. I'm just gonna introduce our speakers for tonight. Rabbi Aryeh Klapper is the dean of the Center for Modern Torah Leadership and Rosh Beit Midrash of its summer program. He's a member of the Boston Beit Din, and he graduated from YU and received from Reitz. Dr. Daniel Reinhold is a professor of modern Jewish philosophy at Rebbe Graduate School. He received his PhD from London School of Economics after his graduation from Cambridge. I'd like to thank everybody who put in work for putting this all together. I'd particularly like to thank Soy, Shua Brick, Aryeh Laufer, Bnei Abizli, and the RAF 14. There's a sheet going around.
That's it? Okay. My recorder isn't working, so I hope someone else's is.
Sorry, one more thing.
Yes.
If you guys have any questions, you can text your questions to that number, and I'll be asking them to the speakers afterwards.
Okay, thank you very much for inviting me. Really thank Michael for making the initial arrangements. And I'm very grateful to Professor Reinhold for agreeing to be the respondent and thereby attracting so many people to come to the program. I should say that the reason I'm very grateful that he's here, but also makes me a little bit nervous, is that when I was undergraduate, I was often very turned off, I think, in a certain way when Rosh Yeshiva talked about philosophy. We had the memory that people have of the Rav saying those professors of Talmud should just talk stick to their field. And at the time, I thought of myself as being a philosophy person. And then when I started making arrangements with Michael, Michael said, "You're going to talk about halacha, right? Because that's what your focus is." And that was sort of like a wake up call. Oh my goodness, what have I become? So I'm really glad to get to exercise some possibly atrophied muscles, and looking forward very much to a sharp critique, and hope at the end either you won't think of me as Rosh Hashiva, or you'll decide that the dichotomy is no longer as compelling, perhaps as it was back in my day to some extent. So we're talking about ethics-based challenges to emunah, ethics-based challenges to faith. And there are a couple of preliminary questions you have to ask about that. One is, faith in what? What is it that you have faith in that's being challenged? Now, you have to ask lots of other questions, like, what does it mean to have faith in something? We're going to bracket all those sorts of questions. But I want to set up by stating that you do have to ask the question, what is it that you have faith in? And then you have to talk about what kind of response you're trying to have to those challenges. So the first thing I want to say is, in terms of the response, what I'm looking for is existential approaches as opposed to formal theodicies. I'm not looking for ways to justify how God can command a certain thing. I'm trying to figure out, and I'm not really interested in abstractions that aren't compelling. The example we used to give about that was somebody comes to you and says that they're not sure they believe in God, and you present them with a version of the ontological argument. Right, you know, say the really simple version, you say, well, God is perfect, it would be a flaw in God's perfection were he not to exist, therefore God exists, and expect them to be satisfied. Oh, that's fine. Now, even if they don't know Kant's reaction that existence is not a predicate, it might be that they'll just say, you know what, that's not really what was bothering me. And what's bothering me is a lack of sense of faith, and presenting a purely abstract argument is not going to solve that. So I'm not looking for abstractions, I'm looking for approaches that are helpful psychologically when what you're experiencing is a clash between what you understand as the demand of ethics, however you arrive at your sense of ethics, and what you understand as the demands of halacha. Second thing, I guess an illustration of that is, so the kind of problem that's addressed with theodicy is, how can God allow suffering in the world? The kind of problem we're addressing is, how can God command you to do something that causes suffering, even though, truthfully, that probably the worst thing that God could conceivably ever command you to do will cause a lot less suffering than God allows in the world. Right? It's just a drop in the bucket, literally. You know, that tsunamis are a much bigger theodicy problem than whether you should carry the groceries of a little old lady on Shabbos outside the Erev. But for our purposes, we're interested in the challenges caused by halakha, and not by the existence of evil in the world. Secondly, what I want to say is that you can address challenges to emunah either propositionally or affectively. And you can address it by saying, look, there's a series of things that I believe in. That's what it means to have faith. I believe the proposition that God exists. I believe the proposition that that the Torah is from God, and that the Torah generates a legal system. I believe the proposition that Orthodox Judaism as it currently exists is the legitimate heir of the legal system extends from the Torah that God commanded. And so those are three basic propositions, and we could try and figure out for each of these challenges, which do they challenge? They challenge the notion that God exists. They challenge the notion that God exists and commands the Torah. Do they challenge the proposition that God exists and commands the Torah, and the halachic system as we have it is the mandatory outgrowth of the Torah that God commands? Or you have an affective challenge, which I would say is best addressed in the context of a plausibility structure. My life is organized around finding halacha meaningful. The reality, right, the way in which I experience this halachic framework, this halachic thing, makes it hard for me to live my life feeling that it's meaningful. And I haven't really worked out whether that means I don't think God exists, or whether it means that I think God doesn't command the Torah, whether it means that I think we have halacha wrong. Right, those are two different kinds of approaches. So what I'm trying to offer is a set of existential approaches, some of which will be useful for addressing propositional challenges, and some of which will be useful in addressing challenges of plausibility structures. So the framework that we're going to use is I have 8 models that I think can offer ways of approaching challenges to emunah. I have conveyed the very bare bones of those 8 approaches to Dr. Reinhold. So I'm going to present the first 3 as a group and talk about how they might work, and he's going to respond to those 3, unless he chooses to respond earlier. And then, as we go through it, I'll present the others in sequence. But the way we're going to do it is I'm going to present the model, or a series of models, and Dr. Reinhold will respond. And then I'll decide if I feel that I want to respond to that as well. And then either fisticuffs will erupt, or we'll go on. we'll go on to the next one, maybe that you yourselves will be so inspired that fisticuffs will erupt in the background of the audience as well. But we encourage you to delay those until after the fundamental program. Here are the first 3. I would say the first 3 of the 8 models that I'm using are all predicated on the word humility. By humility means the awareness of the possibility that one is wrong, and the willingness in some way to change one's behavior or attitude on the basis of the recognition of the possibility that one is wrong. Now, one should be very leery of this kind of humility. There's a whole yeshiva tradition about, right, you need a shmini shmini of gaiva. Right, you need some kind of arrogance. I tend to use it more quoting Lincoln. You need firmness in the right as God gives you to see the right. You have to be aware that you might be wrong, but you still need firmness in the right. But nonetheless, it seems to me that addressing these sorts of issues, that it's useful to think about humility. So the first form of humility is just humility relative to God. I say, you know what? This is what I think is right, and this is what halakha says, and maybe God's right, and I'm not. Now, the interesting thing about that is that really only works if you sort of assume God exists. Because right? the challenge is, well, maybe God doesn't exist because the only God I can believe in is the God who commands this, and I'm worried about whether God commands this, so then it doesn't work so well to say, well, maybe God's right, because your whole challenge is whether God exists. But I tend to think that there is a condition under which you say, you know what, I'm really pretty sure that there is a God, and God commands the Torah, and the Torah commands halacha, but I'm it's just hard for me to deal with the Torah commanding this. It shakes everything. You know what? The answer is, the God I believe in is a lot, right, knows a lot more than I do, and so maybe it's right, and maybe it really is right, I just don't understand why. Right, that's a stance of humility relative to God. Second form of humility is humility relative to great traditional figures. I think in the YU world, the way in which this usually is summed up is in a beautiful piece by Rav Lichtenstein, in which he talks about how he addressed having certain ethical qualms early in his career. Now, he was dealing with Amalek, which in some ways is an easy issue because it doesn't come up so often. Halacha l'maaseh, so you're really dealing with a theoretical challenge. Rav Lichtenstein, in his powerful essay, says that when he was bothered by such issues when he was younger, so he would think back to the Rav's description of Rav Chaim, his grandfather, who would wake up in the middle of the night and check his doorstep to see if somebody had left the family. And he said to himself, you know what, if Rav Chaim, whose ethical sensibility was so well developed, that he would wake up in the middle of the night because of the possibility that there was some random child he'd never heard of before, right, crying on the doorstep for an extra minute, and nonetheless he could deal with the mitzvah of Mechiyat Amalek, so I'm willing, right, I don't know that I would be convinced that this is what God said, but I'm willing to believe that there must be some way of reconciling this with my notion of the good, because here's somebody who I trust as a model of the good, and they can integrate this into the religious outlook. Now this can, in Lichtenstein's case, he had never met Rav Chaim, so in a sense it was really dealing with a constructed fiction. It was an image of Rav Chaim that someone else had constructed, and the issue was whether the narrative depiction of Rav Chaim cohered for him or not. But for many of us, I think, of that generation, really it was a sort of circular thing in which it was the existence of Rav Lichtenstein that made it possible for us to deal with. We'd look at Rav Lichtenstein and say, you know, Lichtenstein really, for us, is a model of ethical sensibility. And if he can go on with halacha as it is, then we must recognize that there must be a way to integrate this into a worldview. Now, there are a number of challenges to that. One is, what happens if the challenge is one that you believe was not faced by prior generations? Because something empirically has changed, or because our knowledge of the world has changed. Let's say it's a challenge raised by the capacity to prolong people's lives long after their brain dies. Right? So that's a new challenge. And you might say that there are ethical challenges raised by that that were not faced in previous generations. Or you might claim that we have understanding of certain kind of biological, genetic, biochemical mechanisms that that raise ethical challenges that didn't exist in the past. And those could conceivably undermine the argument from authority. The authority of prior figures, or alternatively, you could say that I know that this figure in the past has a theological approach that brackets the issue. We'll see in a moment the approach. One of the other approaches I'll make, and I find that approach unsatisfying. So the fact that he could deal with it doesn't say I can deal with it, because he dealt with it in using an intellectual mechanism that I find to be uncompelling. The third approach is not humility relative to specific figures and constructing. Really, the question of whether if I can imagine a great figure of the past who models what I believe to be ethical sensibility, and nonetheless could live in the halacha, that should as well. But humility relative to the tradition as a whole, and say, you know what, the tradition as a whole, really, lots and lots and lots of great people have gone into this, and if they found this particular halacha to cohere with what I understand as being the overall ethical thrust of the tradition, so then perhaps my belief that this doesn't cohere is incorrect, and I should recognize that over 1,000 years somebody would really, particularly if you have if you think that there is a certain amount of or a great amount of subjectivity in the way in which the rabbis dealt with the tradition. If you think, let's say, for example, that the rabbis on occasion used their ethical sensibility to drive their interpretations and argue that certain things should no longer be the halakha, or were never the halakha, so then you would think, okay, so those people who had that ethical sensibility, And the whole tradition, has a way of weeding out ethical problems. It didn't weed this out, so it's not an ethical problem. And I still feel it is, but I have a stance of humility relative to the tradition as a whole. This again, I find this actually very powerful often. I think that humility relative to a tradition is often a good idea. This extent probably early propaganda that I was subjected to about the failures of the French Revolution. The French Revolution was a model of reasoning from first principles. You know what? Reasoning from first principles doesn't always always stand up as well as reasoning through tradition, even if you think that it's more intellectually rigorous. It has the weakness, again, of that if you have issues that have never come up before, so you can say that I'm not actually deferring to the tradition on this issue. The tradition didn't have anything to say about this issue. And what I'm talking about is the current other people who are in power in the tradition, and I don't see any reason I should defer to them unless I see them as great. So then I'll hand over to responses.
Okay. Number one, there won't be any fisty cuffs. As an English gentleman, pistols at dawn, or at least after chakras.
Volunteers for seconds later.
With regard to humility, I think I want to say something in general about humility, and then maybe just pick up on a couple of the points that you mentioned. I'm in a slightly difficult position when it comes to kind of the humility thing, because I know things I can't tell you. and the reason for that is not my humility. The reason for that is actually a very excellent philosopher of this parish, a plug. Tomorrow night, 7:30, Sky Cafe, Professor David Schatz will be talking about theodicy. Professor Schatz has recently written something on humility that he shared with me for comments. And obviously it would be wrong with me to share with you something that he hasn't yet published that he's still working on, but I've got all these thoughts in my head thinking, oh, I want to say that, but I can't. But I will say, just to mention one or two things that kind of, you know, independently could be formulated, but that he takes in much more detail. And one is just to do with the definition of humility. And there are two different aspects to that, and you did make reference to one of them. But of course, Jewish humility is a strange beast. And that kind of, if you like, runs through the tradition, certainly kind of way back in the Tanakh, and certainly modern times. There was maybe more of a blip in medieval times. But as I'm sure many people in this room know, the first time that classic statement of humility was made, v'ani afar v'efer, was just a couple of weeks ago by Avraham Avinu. And when does he say it? When he's arguing with God about the destruction of Sodom. So the notion of humility as some kind of self-negation, it's not at all clear that that's actually our notion of humility. I mean, humility might turn out is a very poor translation for anava, or kind of whatever it is you wish to take as the term. So one thing is just about kind of, does humility really have to lead to one's negating one's own powers of cognition generally, and even one's moral intuitions, given that kind of Abraham very clearly was willing to engage God at the point at which he admitted to his humility. And just to say that, of course, there are exceptions to that, and famously, the Rambam, humility is one of the exceptions to the Midah Benonit, one of the kind of Aristotelian doctrine of the mean, that we should always go kind of down the middle and not to either extreme. But he does talk about humility as being something where that doesn't count. We should be shafal ruach. So, there are different definitions or ideas of humility, certainly. But as I say, right up to modern times, and having spoken briefly to Rabbi Kapp yesterday, I just brought this quote from Rosenzweig. Okay. Rosenzweig says in the Star of Redemption. Okay, people hopefully know Franz Rosenzweig was a kind of early 20th century Jewish existentialist. one of the most interesting biographies of all Jewish philosophers, but we don't have time for that. And in kind of the part of the Star of Redemption where he's talking about revelation, he says the following. He says, humility is, after all, a kind of pride. Okay? Only haughtiness and humility are contradictory. That humility which is conscious of being what it is by the grace of a superior, however, is pride. So much so that it was possible to consider this consciousness of the grace of God as itself veritably a haughty consciousness. Okay? So, now, Rosenzweig is famously impenetrable, but certainly there, it's very clear, this idea of humility as a type of almost pride. And this is the part that kind of sort of moves into something that David Chatz kind of speaks about in this piece, but in much more detail. And that is that the way you defined humility was awareness of the possibility that I'm wrong. Yeah. And it's strange because, on the one hand, humility towards... I mean, that, I would say, is a secular definition of humility, in as much as I think a secular person who is saying I'm humble would agree to that as their form of humility, kind of fallibilism. Yeah, I could be wrong. Any good scientist ought to be a fallible, ought to say, look, you know, this is the best we've got, and I really absolutely believe this, but, you know, things might change. And the problem with that form of humility is that there's a flip side to it that could be arrogance. Okay, so if I'm deeply humble before God, say, and therefore I believe, because God said so, that the world was created in 6 days, kind of, you know, around about 6,000 years ago, is at the same time deeply arrogant towards all the scientific experts that tell me that that's nonsense. So kind of the flip side of humility, depending kind of, you know, which is your horse in the race, so to speak, can be a form of arrogance. And more than that, almost a necessary arrogance. You see, the thing is that when you're humble, you're going to be humble. But, you know, when it comes to something that you absolutely deeply kind of believe in, so for example, in that situation, why aren't we all humble? Okay, some people are. Yeah, some people say, yeah, God's got it right and science is wrong. But other people, you know, aren't being humble at that point. Why? Because it's very clear to them that that can't be the case. Morally, let us say, it might have been very clear to Avraham Avinu that can't be the case. And therefore, whether or not humility can allow us to avoid that kind of very deeply troubling idea that morally this can't be the case, I'm not sure the structure of humility can actually achieve that for us, particularly because the things that we're going to hold dear are the things we're most certain about. And frankly, you know, maybe the thing that we think we're so certain about, which might be, say, an interpretation of a pasuk or something, why should we be any less humble about that interpretation than we are about the moral kind of imperative that we seem to think is being contradicted by it? So kind of humility generally, I think, is a very slippery topic. I'm not sure how to define it. I'm not sure that defining it will allow us, or at least I think we'd have to define it in a way that presupposes already certain kind of ethical stances, such that I'm not sure it will do the work we need to kind of, you know, distinguish when we should and when we shouldn't be humble. So, yeah, I guess that's...
Okay, so I'll make a few brief comments. I think one very useful... First of all, I hope that Dr. Schatz will be willing to share it with me as well, although I own comments on the last time we both spoke about the same topic on holiness and apparently said exactly opposite things. But, you know, Mori Varabi in philosophy. I think that you're 100% right that it is not a good idea to associate anava directly with English humility with the term anava.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's correct. The King James translated as meekness, which I remember years ago, like, discovering. I don't know how many of you... Can you all hear me, by the way, in back? Miriam, can you hear me? That the meek shall inherit the earth was actually in Tehillim, and it's Vanavim Yerushuaretz, and if the word meek has changed meaning over time, then that was the translation of Anav. So I think that's correct, and I think that I didn't do the work to ground the definition of humility, which I think you're right is very closely associated with fallibilism, in Jewish sources. And to work this out, I'd have to figure out the specific Jewish sources. And I cheated by using Gaiva as the right in the Goan sense as the antonym. And so calling me on that is perfectly legitimate. I find it very hard to believe that there isn't, that I can't do a job of grounding fallibilism in Jewish sources, and it won't be connected to character in some way. And I'm not so bothered by, one of the issues obviously is it's always correct that when you say I'm just listening to God, what you really mean is I'm just insisting on my interpretation of what God said. Because right? It's very often, unless two people have the exact same experience of God, right, you can't have an argument about whether you're not listening to God, right? So I think that's always the case.
Mm-hmm.
But from an existential perspective, I can find ways of living with that. And then I have my own issue, how do I deal with that? But as dealing with the question of having an ethical challenge, so, sometimes I'm confident God said it, and sometimes I'm not.
Right.
So when I'm confident God said it, then I can have a stance of humility up to God. And when I'm not confident God said it, I can have a stance of humility relative to other interpreters. That doesn't bother me quite as much.
Okay. I think the interesting thing is which is the cart and which is the horse, here, so to speak, in terms of I have to be humble in order to kind of give myself over to something I don't understand ethically, or is it the fact that we'll draw the line at where we'll be humble because of our preconceptions about ethics? So that's why I'm not sure, is it humility that can drive this, or is the ethics actually the underlying thing that will tell you when to be humble?
I guess what I would say is that we have this situation in many areas in life where there are other people, and sometimes we think the other person is right and that matters, and sometimes, I feel strongly enough about this that you can't be right about this. And I don't know that either God's tradition or that finding some kind of, maybe just be muddling through.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't know that it fails as a psychological approach to the challenge in that way. Okay, so the fourth model I wanted to present is the term I like to use for this is chokification. So using the standard approach in Rashi. And Rashi says that there are laws that are called Mishpatim and laws that are called Chukim, and Mishpatim are laws that have humanly apprehensible reasons, and Chukim are rules that either have no humanly comprehensible reason, or perhaps have no reason at all other than imposing obedience. And recognizing that the term chok doesn't mean that anywhere else, right? That chok in the Spanish tradition means something like mitzvot that are harder to understand the reasons. Right? But I want to use the term in Rashi sense. So in that sense, so the question is, can it work to say there is this halakha that seems like a deep ethical challenge to me, and I am going to treat this as saying, I have a halakhic system that generally makes sense to me, and that generally I think works in accordance with ethical and moral principles that I find coherent and comprehensible. But this one doesn't. So I'm just going to say, okay, that must be something that God commanded for some reason that is beyond human comprehension, or because there's something that is, the extreme version is what we call the teleological suspension of the ethical, right? The one philosophic phrase that all of us know. Usually the halakha is ethical, but this thing is just a moment where I have to say that obedience to God is more important than ethics. So now the challenge of the process of chokification, and first of all, you have to buy into this notion, perhaps, that there are mitzvot or halachot that don't fit, that don't have an obviously discoverable, comprehensible purpose. And as I said initially, that may be true for Rashi, but not for anyone else. At least not for anyone outside that tradition. Secondly, in order to make this work for contemporary challenges, what you'll often have to do is say there are mitzvot that have traditionally been regarded as obviously in the category of chukim. And if I had asked anybody up to the 20th century, they'd said, what's the reason for this?
they would have said, this is the reason for it. It makes perfect sense to me. And now we're faced with a challenge where things that used to make sense to us no longer do. Right? So we're assigning things as chukim that would previously have been regarded as mishpatim. So is that fair? Or is that fair or is it not fair? To say, you know what? I'm just going to take this halakha and I'm going to say, this halakha exists in a black box. Now, putting it in a black box also has legal implications, often that you have to decide if you want to buy or not. It often has a legal implication that you'll narrow it as much as possible. And you'll say, well, because I don't understand this, nothing else is going to be derived from it legally. On the other hand, it also is not susceptible to interpretation in the way other mitzvot are, because other mitzvot, other halachot, you say, well, it can't apply there because there it wouldn't make sense, but here you're saying it doesn't make sense anyway. So calling something a chok in that sense really undermines much of the classical model, many of the classical models of legal interpretation. It often requires you to be willing to take a stance that is philosophically against much of the past tradition, even if it allows you to square it legally. The third thing is whether it really works. What it sets up for you is the claim that when I try and think about the principles by which I should live my life, I think about all of halakha except that. That's just something I do. It doesn't matter to me at all. So does that really work? Is it really... So I'll give you the paradigm way of thinking about this is Berlichtenstein's essay about Amalek, although after this was published on Mavasser, by now Rabbi Nachum Spern. And when I edited Amavasser, I was told by my friend David Mastis and Schoen that the Chavetz Chaim said the exact same thing, which I thought was a wonderful model, wonderful example of parallel evolution. So they both addressed the problem of how Shaul could lose his kingdom for not killing Agag. And the solution they both come up with is that killing Amalek is something that is so incomprehensible ethically that the only conceivable justification for doing it is if you believe that God commanded it absolutely and it has no rationale at all. You couldn't possibly, right? If the moment you think it makes sense, you're a horrible person. Because good people don't think genocide is legitimate. And good people would think that the reason Shaul loses the kingship is because he killed Amalek. Right? The rest of Amalek, including the women and children, forget the sheep. Not because he spared one person. So Lichtenstein and Chavetz Chaim both came to the argument that the reason Shaul loses the kingdom is because by not killing Agag, he created he made it clear that he believed you could reason about the commandment to kill Amalek. You could say, oh, that person it makes sense for me not to kill. And that meant that the reason he killed the rest of Amalek was not because it was absolute divine command that he was submitting. It meant he thought it made sense. He was a horrible person. He was a mass murderer. He committed genocide. That was an approach which is a classic model of chokification. Right? Here is the commandment to kill Amalek. You might think this is a perfectly rational commandment. It's about revenge. It's about memory. It's about eradicating evil from the world. No. The mitzvah to kill Amalek is absolutely just divine command, which you're not allowed to reason about. The moment you reason about it, you become a murderer as opposed to somebody carrying out Dvar Hashem. So the question is this a good solution for dealing with Amalek, or is it just a profoundly dangerous solution? And in the end, what it does, you can do this with every mitzvah. You end up saying, like, I'm a good person, I follow ethics and morals, except when halakha tells me not to. And whenever it seems to me halakha is telling me not to, my reaction is to say, oh, that's because that's just a divine command which I learned nothing from. And so I do all the horrible things that halakha, right, that might be conceivably be the interpretation of halakha, because, after all, those are just chukim. And don't judge me. Because I do them with absolute religious sincerity. So I have gone back and forth over the years. This was a Parshat Zachor. I used to teach that for our Torah for Lutzin every year. And over the years, I yo-yoed from being highly enthusiastic about it to being terribly scared of it, despite its power. But I leave that as a model, whether it works. You'll notice that in many of the areas, which I imagine we'll get to at the end, in which people raise challenges to halakha nowadays, often one of the reactions is for people to say, you know what, you're right, I don't understand why this is, but it's a chok. And therefore we can deal with it. So I put that as a model.
So I think you did a pretty good job of critiquing your own one then, or of pointing out the implications. So I just kind of add a couple of things, I guess implications or matters of interest to consider in relation to it. One would be, in particularly thinking about maybe contemporary ethical challenges that fall under this rubric, it does somewhat, and you know, obviously, what I'm about to say, you can just say yeah and swallow it, which is fine. But just in terms of an implication, would be it would remove us from the realm of moral discourse with anybody outside of Judaism. Yeah, so we would no longer be able to argue or kind of, you know, speak beyond kind of Orthodox Judaism to anybody about these matters, because the fact is we're saying, well, no, kind of it's nothing to do with reason, it's just a hook. And therefore, there simply is no way for us to have any discussion with kind of, you know, society more widely about particular, say, ethical issues. So that's just one implication that it's, as I say, one can swallow it, but it's just something to note that, you know, to write these things off as chukim removes us from the world of universal moral discourse about that particular thing, and therefore it is indeed completely insulated. Something else, again, just out of interest, would be, I guess, the broader theology come philosophy of mitzvot that might bring with it. So just because they're, you know, modern figures that people here might have read and heard of and that I've been talking about lately anyway, you know, you could put this as Yishai Leibowitz versus Eliezer Berkowitz, yeah? In terms of, you know, if you believe, as Berkowitz certainly seems to, that, you know, the realm of chukim or ritual per se are all about training you for the ethical, then that's going to become a very difficult position to take, which is fine, because you don't have to take its position. Yeah? But it's just kind of, you know, that would not be then your kind of background theology. Instead, kind of, you know, with Leibowitz, where you do have subordination. You do have, look, there's this, you know, very wonderful and valuable human social practice called ethics, and it's a wonderful thing, but just don't confuse it with religion, which is something else altogether, which kind of, again, you know, takes us back to, can we have moral discourse with anybody if we really accept that view? So yeah, it's, you know, that approach, I guess, brings with it a more general philosophy of mitzvot, which, as I say, is fine. If that's the philosophy of mitzvot that you buy, then everything's consistent and coherent. But I guess, yeah, those are just a couple of implications of the view that struck me.
So there's one I want to try and just work out from my own thinking, because this is a useful push. The second issue is really going back to Rashi versus Rambam.
100%. Yeah, no,
right? You know, and that's a the issue of you know, of insularity. So I think that I agree that I think that we should have a bias towards being able to communicate morally with people around us.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always a loss when you have to block something in the chok box as opposed to be able to engage in moral discourse. What I'm trying to argue, and I'm not sure it'll work out, is so I think the originality of the term chokification is that in Rashi's universe, things are either chukim or mishpatim, and those conditions are not changeable.
Right.
They're objective. Right, they're objective conditions. What I'm trying to argue is that there's a psychological, there's a recognition that certain things will be mishpatim in some eras,
mm-hmm.
and those things may be chukim in others. And so there's a psychological, I'm going to avoid using the word existential just to sound fancy, stance that you can take and say that I relate to this in the way that Rashi said we should relate to chukim, while suspending judgment about what it actually is objectively.
All right, so that's the move I'm trying to edit.
All right, so that just to come back, it's interesting that, you know, I kind of put hockification in the Leibovitz camp, yeah? Somebody once said, I can't remember who it was, you don't really rise from the shadow Leibovitz, which, forgive me, but... and it's interesting that he has something very similar, particularly in his approach, kind of very short piece on metahalacha and the status of women, where he basically distinguishes between two types of mitzvot. Which he does anyway, generally. There are constitutive mitzvot, mitzvot that create their own reality, so to speak. Compare it to the game of chess. Okay? The game of chess exists because there are rules of the game of chess. Yeah? There isn't some independent reality out there called chess just waiting for its rules to kind of, you know, come about. It's created by... And there are mitzvot like that, according to Leibovitz, yeah? Most of the kind of chukim and most ritual mitzvot, tefillin. Yeah, tefillin doesn't mean anything, it's just God told you to do it, so that creates a reality. For him, tumah tahara, yeah, there's no such thing really as kind of metaphysical purity and impurity, it's created by the system of law. And then there are traffic laws. There will be traffic anyway, so we need some laws to deal with it. Okay, so there's a regulative law, so they regulate a pre-existing reality. Unlike chess, it's not a pre-existing reality, traffic is, we need laws to deal with it. So there are mitzvot like that too, where there are kind of certain realities and we have to deal with those realities. Now, Leibovitz puts this distinction to work in this piece on the status of women, where he argues that things like women's learning, Talmud Torah, things like public kind of, you know, positions of public service and leadership, where these were things that women could not do, he said, yeah, but those are regulative issues. Yeah, as in, you know, the world of learning exists, the world of public leadership exists, and you've got to regulate it. So you regulate it in accordance with society as it is at the time, and now things have changed, so maybe you regulate it differently. Yeah, not maybe, for him, actually, he says, yeah, that kind of if you continue to kind of, you know, eliminate women from Talmud Torah public positions, it will destroy Judaism. Yeah, he actually seems to have this kind of teleological view here, that, you know, genuinely, you know, if we don't, this will be the end. Yeah, so therefore we have to change it. But tefillin, it's meaningless. Okay. If you understood mitzvot properly, you wouldn't want to do it. Because there's no independent reason to do it. Guys do it because they had to, because they were told to. It's completely meaningless. So to wish to do it reflects a complete misunderstanding. Okay. Now, it's all very well, but actually the sliding scale thing starts to come into effect. Because if we live in a society where actually, let's say, you know, I don't know, going to shul on Shabbat and... you know, just the very idea of being part of a minyan, yeah, suddenly becomes an absolutely central part, kind of like conservative responses on driving to shore, but it becomes really the way that so many people centrally identify, such that it's no longer meaningless. So does that now become a thing that's actually kind of got to change in order to regulate rather than a chok that is kind of meaningless? I think there's almost a shifting scale for him as well in a similar way. So kind of the fact that kind of you discuss that and you say that kind of goes quite nicely with the fact that it's a Leibovitzian kind of approach.
So that's what I have to think about. You know, generally, I think, like, you know, Leibovitz is a really useful intellectual foil, but the notion that he actually believed that ethics had no relation to religion is psychologically so wholly implausible. An awful lot of coincidences happen.
That's where it all down. Everything is psychologically implausible in history.
So I wouldn't see it as a positive if I was McCartney. If I was trying to construct something. So I think it's distinguishable.
Yes.
I'll leave it at that. Okay, the next model I want to talk about is what I will call, which may very well be a lack of awareness of the reality of this, but it's how I was introduced to a notion called averroism. So averroism I was very unhappy with when I was younger, because I thought of averroism as just being, okay, it's a contradiction, so what? And that didn't work for me very well at all. And the model for me of averroism was the way in which people understand Rashbam and his parash on Chumash. Well, you know what? That's the pshat. That's what the words mean. But the drash is otherwise. That's also what the words mean. Well, who cares? And that made me very unhappy. And then at some point, it occurred to me that actually there was something very powerful going on. I think I finally read an explanation of what was going on with averroism theologically, in some history philosophy of science book, that made sense to me, where, as I understood the argument to be, that you can't affirm any contradiction. What you can do is, you can affirm the legitimacy of different epistemologies, and you can maintain the legitimacy of those epistemologies even if they yield contradictory results. And it's not you don't have to solve the paradox created when different epistemologies yield different results. Right? So it doesn't help you with paradoxes in logical system with all Cretans always lie and things like that, which are paradoxes that are generated within the notion of logic. But maybe if you have, you say, you know what, this is what Rishbam says, perhaps, if that's the correct understanding of him, which I'm not sure. But, you know, but the way in which they taught me Rishbam, they probably taught you also, maybe it's right, that there is this methodology, there is this epistemology of how do you understand Chumash, which is in accordance with what some notion of the words are, the text as a whole is self-interpreting and doesn't require access to a tradition. And then there's another system which claims that the only way to really understand the text is on the basis of a received interpretation, and the notion that you can interpret a text on its own without access to tradition is absurd. And maybe both of those can be true. And if they yield different meanings of the text and meanings of the text that are mutually incompatible, so that's okay, because you know what? No epistemology is perfect. So it's not a big deal. I will just say all our epistemologies are imperfect. We don't need to resolve this. We don't need to resolve this. So by the same token, we can say, look, there's, you know, in terms of figuring out what the right thing to do is, there's an epistemology which we call halakha, which is a way of arriving at the right thing to do by interpreting texts in a particular way. And there's an epistemology which we call ethics, which is a way of figuring out the right thing to do through some combination of reason, intuition, and experience. And those are different epistemologies, and sometimes they yield contradictory results, and we're not ever going to solve that problem. And it's okay, we can live with the contradiction and figure out at some point later whether God can tell us in some way, right? Because every epistemology yields paradoxes, so it doesn't bother us so much if the two yield. Now the problem with this is that if you take Rishbam as the model, so there's Rishbam says, well, there's this epistemology called Pshat, and there's this epistemology called Midrash. They contradict. The text means both even when they directly contradict. But that's not a big deal because we know what to do. We do as we follow the Midrash. So, and the question, and on the other hand, right, so, but it's very powerful for lots of people, I think, right? You know, people say, you know what, I've learned this Near Eastern stuff, I've learned this philological stuff, I've learned parallel Near Eastern texts. Whether their arguments are compelling or not is not my issue. But there are, I think, lots of people who feel that you can arrive at intellectually compelling interpretations of Chumash on the basis of such methodologies, and those intellectually compelling methodologies are not the same as the approach given by Chazal, and they don't want to say that's because Chazal reached those interpretations in error, because they think that Chazal were aware, perfectly aware of these grammatical points, and it wouldn't have changed their minds anyway. And so they say, you know what? There are two different epistemologies, and I can live with the contradiction, but I know what to do. So the question is whether it's a viable stance to say, I believe that ethical reasoning is a viable mode of arriving at knowledge. I don't deny the epistemological legitimacy of reason. I don't deny whatever your mode of ethical reasoning is. I don't deny its epistemological validity. It is a mode of arriving at the right thing to do. And often it's very valuable. But I have another methodology, which is called halakha. And that's also a very valuable thing to do. And often they live in different spheres, and either they reach the same conclusions, and that's great. But sometimes halakha tells me to do this, and ethical reasoning tells me to do that. And I'm not going to claim that means that really it's ethical. I'm not. It's not ethical. And I'm not going to claim that the fact that halakha contradicts ethics means that either that ethics is wrong or that ethics is required to submit to halakha. That's not true. I'm just going to live with the contradiction. You know what? That there are two ways of knowing what's right, and those two ways contradict. So the challenge with that is, of course, that we'll say, yes, but don't you have to decide what to do?
And how do you decide what to do? So it'd be easy to say, well, you just do what people say to an Rishon, which is, well, we follow. So the answer there is, in most places, people don't have an overwhelming desire to follow what Rishon says as Pshat, because who really cares? All right, maybe, right, if you think, again, this is all, I have my doubts about whether Rashbam says any of this, but working in that universe, right? Let's suppose that you think Rashbam really means that there's no mitzvah to put, you know, the Pshat Mechumash is that there's no mitzvah to put black boxes on your arms. Okay, so we put black boxes on our arms. Right, anyway, so what? Right, it's not a big deal. So the question is whether that would really work if you feel, right, that the halacha is compelling you to engage in unethical action or to refrain from ethical action, are you okay saying, well, I know, I really think that there's a legitimate, I can sustain the position that this is wrong, but at the same time, I can also sustain the position that it's right. And I live with the contradiction, that solves my existential angst. It doesn't mean, for example, that I have to lose faith in my ethical reasoning everywhere else, because no, ethics is a really good motive for achieving truth, but in this particular case, they're both true, and I have a decision procedure. A model, along the models of saying, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, ve'alacha kedivrei Behila. Right? The fact that I believe the two things are, if you understand, again, I don't want to claim that's what the Gemara means, but if you want a model for it, there are interpretations which say each of these things are true, and yet one of them is the mode of action, but it doesn't bother me if I think the other one is also true. I don't think it's even less true. It's just the truth that doesn't lead to action right now. Okay.
All right, so we start talking about different epistemologies. I get very excited because I'm very into what Rostovetchik calls epistemological pluralism, or what Nietzsche calls perspectivism. The problem is, I don't think that actually fits what you're talking here about in terms of different epistemologies. So kind of, you know, their view, at least as I read it, is that there are indeed different bodies of knowledge that are legitimate bodies of knowledge, and they are based on different objectives and different sets of values, and therefore they don't actually ever yield contradictions. The point here being that everything always, according to these views, all knowledge is driven by values. Okay? So, you know, let's go back to the example we had before about creation versus kind of, you know, the scientific version of things. You know, so there is a view that would say, well, they're trying to do different things. Yeah, science is trying to do science. Right, if you want to do science, then you do science, and that gives you a scientific conclusion. Religion is trying to do religion. It's not trying to do science. It's trying to do something else. So, you know, Bereshit's not actually trying to tell you how things were kind of made and stuff. So, you know, there are different approaches that kind of can be sought because they have different kind of objectives. Okay, and that's an easy one. But actually, it goes further than that. Because, for example, a physicist and a biologist might use different concepts of time, okay? And a religious person, for that matter, okay? Can you change the past? Yeah, not according to kind of, you know, science. Yes, according to Russell Vachik's theory of tshuva. Now, the point is, they're not arguing with each other. Yeah, Russell Vachik isn't saying for one second that when you're in a lab, if it doesn't go right, go back in time and change it. That's not what he's saying. Yeah. So, different epistemologies that have different kind of approaches carve up reality in different ways. But the point is, they don't contradict each other. So, when it comes to two epistemologies here, kind of ethics and religion, that actually are trying to argue about the very same thing, I'm not sure whether, kind of, I'm just not sure how we're going to individuate epistemologies anymore. As in, our epistemology is going to be kind of any difference of opinion is a different epistemology. So, you know, if you can genuinely see how a certain discipline, yeah, might have a certain epistemology and it has a certain objective and certain values that lead it to X, and someone else has leads it to Y, but nobody's confused and nobody thinks there's a contradiction there because they can understand that distinction. In this case, given that we are ending up in the same place and with a contradiction on the very same thing, appears more like just a clash of values rather than a different epistemology. So that makes sense.
I mean, if I understand, and again, this is, I think Averroes came up with this precisely to resolve the difficulty you're raising, and he did not choose to adapt to take the approach to, well, you know, nature of truth. So the question, right, so you're saying is that you think that Averroes doesn't survive in modernity because all epistemologies are about values, and therefore the notion that you have distinct epistemologies dealing with different spheres that contradict is implausible.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so that's that's an interesting modern critique. I couldn't get the article on Russellovich and Nietzsche in advance. So I didn't have a chance to read that. That's a...
I suppose it comes down to I was never very convinced by the Averroes approach, but...
Right, so I'm saying my own evolution was...
And you also...
My own evolution was that early I wasn't, and then at some point, possibly influenced by the way in which people are comfortable with Rashbam, even though it always drove me crazy. How can you be comfortable with this notion of Rashbam? So it makes me at least, whether it's my own stance or not, right, as setting up a model that will be useful for people, it seems to me that, in fact, it does have psychological, psychological value. And then we can talk about how that relates to analytic value.
Right. I guess my problem with it is if it's just kind of living with contradiction, then I don't think it's moved us on.
Right. So the question is,
we started off with a contradiction.
Right. Living with contradiction is one. Yeah. You're right. Living with contradiction, it's a claim that you can live with certain kinds of contradictions differently than you do others.
That's right.
Right. And the issue is, so you're claiming that in your analytic world, there is only one kind of contradiction.
So to speak.
Right?
Yeah.
So the question is, right?
Just not.
The people have to accept it. Right. So that would be a cool thing to work out.
Yeah.
Okay. Probably because time pressure, I should probably present the last three together, and then we can talk. So the. So the last three models present as follows. So the first one, which I have to say is one that has always mattered a great deal to me, is to say that my contention is that in halakha there has never been a claim that one is required to believe that the existing halakhic system, that the conclusions of the existing halakhic system are true. Meaning that the conclusions of the existing halakhic system are what God would want them to be if God controlled the system directly. That the rule of the Lotasur always is that you're not allowed to tell people to act against the law, but there is no restriction whatsoever to claim that the law is wrong. So it might be that one stance you have when you feel that the halakha as we have it is unethical, is to say, you know what, I think that the halakha as we have it is unethical, but it doesn't change the fact that it is the halakha and it's binding. It's just wrong, and I wish the halakha were different. So there are all sorts of ways in which this has to be parsed more deeply. One of them, for example, is how deep does the error go? Right, so it's... And that relates to the question. In this system, you have to explain what the justification for obedience is if you think the system is wrong. And I think there are at least two basic models for justifying obedience. One is to say the system as a whole is good, and the damage of disobedience in a particular would outweigh the good of disobedience in this particular case. That's the approach of the Drasha Haran, for example. And that, of course, runs to the issue of what maybe there are some things that are so wrong, right, that they override that, but it's not, right, that's one kind of model. A second kind of model is to say that the system is participatory, and therefore, and by disobeying the system, you remove yourself from the discourse, you no longer have an impact, you no longer have the capacity to impact the way in which God's word is interpreted, and one of the most important things is to make sure that God's word is interpreted correctly. And so therefore, this is what we might call the democratic justification. Right? So it's okay to obey the administration of somebody who you think is, insert your horrific adjectives, right? And you might think that this administration is going to do all sorts of horrible things, but that enables you to preserve democracy, and it's not because democracy during this period is better than, right? It's worth obeying the democratic ruler, the democratic administration for the next 4 years, because disobedience would be worse than the consequences. It's because
we obey so that we can still vote in 4 years. So maybe the reason to live within the halakhic system now is because by living in the halakhic system, you get to be the people who have an impact on the way in which halakha will be interpreted tomorrow. By remaining a member of an Orthodox synagogue, you get to vote for the next rabbi. And leave the Orthodox synagogue, you don't get to vote for the next rabbi, and that changes the... So I think those are the... they're on the right. Again, it depends on how that justification itself depends on how plausible it is to believe that there will be change. How entrenched the metahalakhic principles are that would cause change, how you perceive the political issue. But I think those are two different ways, and I can say that for myself, that's really a big part. I think autobiographically was a good way of living with saying I think this is wrong. Or as somebody who I won't quote by name said to me once, the Torah is perfect, it's human beings that messed it up. It doesn't challenge my faith, because the Torah is still perfect. Human beings messed it up. And I think that it's probably is part of what drove both of us to end up going into the world of Orthodox Halakha. Because we felt that if you're going to think that, then you should actually be involved in trying to make the interpretations happen that you believe are truly in accordance with the will of God. But I think it's a very important to notion, right? The notion that you have to believe that the system as it is absolutely correct, and I think simply false. And then it requires, you end up with an Orwellian universe in which you have to forget. In 2016 that halakha was different in 2011. Because the halakha system was perfect then and it's perfect now, right? So what happened, right? So you end up, those are which Professor Shapiro enjoys, putting together the cases in which we have to retrospectively claim that the halakha was different than it is nowadays. So that's one which I have to say that I have a deep affection for, and it still matters for me a great deal. I would say, though, it's also true psychologically that people who use this approach tend to get more radical practically as they get older, become less hopeful of winning those political battles in their lifetime. It's just a psychological observation watching certain people, and that's something to watch out for, I guess, for me in a few years ago. unless, of course, I win. which is a consummation devoutly to be desired. The last two, so one of them, which Professor Reinhold made reference to earlier, is arguing with God. So this will take us back to humility as a stance that, maybe God knows more than I do. So arguing with God is a stance that says, maybe God's wrong. But the fact that God's wrong doesn't, and then I'm really convinced that God is wrong, doesn't change the nature of my relationship with him in a sense of obedience. Because my job is to be there and argue with God, and hopefully he'll change his mind. And so if I find halachot that bother me, I spend my time yelling at God and davening, and eventually, whatever way that God reflects his will, God will change his mind. So that, the model of Abraham is there. Of course. I think that's also a big part of the message of Yonah, that arguing with God is a legitimate stance, but that the price of a stance of arguing with God is you have to have standing, and standing is a function of obedience. That's my own take on it. So the question is, nowadays we don't experience the Word of God through direct revelation. And so you can't, right? So it's hard to figure out how do you change God's mind? Right? Let's suppose that I am thoroughly convinced that, in fact, it's wrong not to weave wool and linen together. Right? It violates all my ethical principles about the unity of the animal. Right? It entrenches the bias towards animate over, right? Towards animal over vegetable matter, that vegetable life. And actually, we are murdering cabbages left and right. We should stop doing this at once. And this is all because God said, "Don't weave wool and linen together." And so I'm going to go yell at God. So what? Right? What is that? Right, what does that mean? So in order to, so one possibility is that the purpose of arguing with God is not to change God's mind. the purpose of arguing with God is just to enable you to maintain your relationship with God while you have ethical qualms with what he commands. Right, it's not intended to have practical results at all. This is this you might call in many ways Elie Wiesel theology. But arguing with God has no pragmatic practical results at all. It's just, how else can I deal with it, God? Right? I have a genuine awareness of the presence of God. On the other hand, I have this constant sense that God is doing things that I disapprove of strongly. So I'll argue with him. That's what I do. There are all sorts of philosophic baggage that will come with this. Right? Does that require you to believe in a fallible God? And those actually don't interest me at all. Where you can work out all the fancy ways. Whatever people have managed to read Avraham Etzdom and the Rambam for years and years together, and you know there are ways to do it. If the purpose of arguing with God, the way the stance works, is because you might change God's mind, that's the purpose of arguing. So then you have to say that this stance is in some way adaptable to within the experience of Talmud Torah. That when you're studying halacha, you experience that as God talking to you. I find that very powerful. And that when you're learning, you can say, oh my goodness, that can't possibly be true, and you start yelling at the Gemara, and that's really yelling at God. And yes, in some ways it might be that you get an answer in the form of discovering a new interpretation that didn't exist previously. And I think those are two different models of the argument with God. The last model that I want to talk about, which I'm not sure has any meaning at all. I actually taught this at Columbia just before I came here to check if it had meaning, and it wasn't at all clear it had meaning at all at the end. But I think it's really, really cool anyway. Some of you know that other than codification, my other contribution to the world of philosophy is that there are actually three criteria for truth. There is coherence, correspondence, and coolness. So this one probably meets the coolness criteria, even if it doesn't meet either the coherence or the correspondence criteria. So Rav Huttner, dealing with Locus Classicus, in some way of dealing with clashes between ethics and divine command, is the Akedah. So Rav Huttner moves into the world of Gemara, and he says the following. I'm giving you Rashi Tevot, and again, it should take more than an hour to just get out the first five sentences here, but we'll get it out this way. You look at it yourself. What he says is that Kachnat binchai et yichidcha asher hafta Yitzchak lechecha l'eretz Amoriya v'halei v'sham li'olah. That was the Havamim. Al tishlach yitcha l'nara v'eltas l'mumma. That was the Maskana. When you're reading the Gemara, you have to really believe the Havamim. Or you won't understand it, right? You're not supposed to be thinking, oh, it says kasal v'datam, so this doesn't matter. You're supposed to be really living through the Havamina. But he says, so here's, this is his point, he says that there are some maskanos that you can only reach at the point when you become fully committed to the Havamina. And you imagine, I'm talking about a character named Alfred Avinu. Alfred Avinu was told by God, Tachnat Bitcha Yichicha Asher Hafta Yitzchak, and he went to Har Moriah, and he got to the top of the mountain, and he took his son and he put him on top of the wood, and he was about to light the fire when he said, hang on a second. Fire? Nobody said anything about fire. He said, Halei Yerusham Li'olah. So I did that. That's what God really meant, because God would never command anything unethical. And then, right, so he takes Yitzchak off the son, they walk down the hill together and out of history. Right? And we only know there were thousands of people who were commanded this way. Now Avraham Avinu was the first one who got to the point. So Rav Huttner says that all those people, I think, this is my projection of Rav Huttner perhaps, all those people previously, they don't really know that God won't command this. They're just really making a decision that they will choose their ethics over God when it comes down to it. They don't know that God won't command them. It's only Avram who's really willing to do it who forces God's hand to say, no, I would never do that. Even though God never meant it. So Rav Huttner says this about many things, but that's his, all right, it's called a theology of the Havamina, which is that you say, you know what, I am willing to believe this utterly, And at the moment, I have a sort of a willing suspension of disbelief that I don't consider the possibility that this is only Havamina. But at the same time, I do know that there are other people who have lived Havaminas and turned out they were wrong. At the end, Avraham Avinu didn't go through it. So Rav Huttner claims that the way he interprets Maaseh Avot Siman L'Banim is that it's not that we're supposed to act the way our ancestors were, but that we have sort of a genetic inheritance of the experiences our ancestors went through. And we can relive it. So we can relive Avraham at that moment. At the same time, we also have access to Avraham and the Maskana, and that you can live in the contradiction that way. That you can live a Havamina in the completely and thoroughly in the awareness that it is only a Havamina. So whether that works or not, I'm not entirely sure. I thought I would throw it out to you, and I'll try and write it up again at some point soon, and hopefully it'll generate a storm of reaction, because if it works, it's really, really cool. But I'm not sure at all. What came out in the earlier session at Columbia, I think, was right. Rav Huttner says this, by analogy, he says that the same thing is true of Noach lo adam shelo nivra, be better if human beings not to have been created. And at the same time, the creation of human beings is tov me'ud. So the answer is you have to be aware of the devastation that human choice can create in order to realize the power of human choice, things like that. And I think it works really well there in lots of ways, but I'm not sure it works for the Akedah. I'm not sure it works for ethics. So I'll leave it with let it run off the last comment.
I don't know if, given time, we should just open it at this point to questions.
You can respond.
Briefly respond. So the first one, actually, like you, I have, I guess I'm in great sympathy with, mainly because, and this is true of, I know we said at the beginning, not about theodicy, but one of my problems with theodicy is coming to terms with evil. As in, if there's an explanation for it, then okay, an explanation for it. I get it, understand it. I don't want to come to terms with it. I always want to think, no, it's absolutely terrible. The idea that I would come to terms with it is not a great thing. So, similarly, the idea that one can kind of genuinely struggle with these things and actually think, you know what, I really don't get this. This really is wrong to me and I'm going to argue that. But the only way to do that authoritatively is from within the system and not from without. I don't have that much to say against that, frankly, because I'm quite rather in sympathy with it myself. And up to a point, I see the arguing with God one as being quite similar, in as much as kind of there are certain things where I just, you know, can't take it lying down, and I feel that kind of I have to object. It's something interesting you said about God changing his mind. I don't think that's a problem. He does that a lot. Rabbis changing their mind, on the other hand, that's a whole different thing. That might be more of our issue. The Rav Huttner one just reminds me of the Yerushalmi and Sanhedrin about, 49 reasons to let our hair and 49 reasons. Yeah, you've got to kind of have to. But there is something to taking something with which you disagree incredibly seriously in order to actually come out the other end. Again, I don't know that it will actually work in this case, but yeah. In fact, I don't have much to say on that one. I'd have to think about it more. But okay. Leave it at that.
Alright, there are a lot of questions, so I guess we're gonna try to take some good questions. Okay, I guess fine. Okay. So here's one question. How could a mortal man, a mortal human being, have come up with some ethical innovation that that God might consider over his brilliance?
So, you want to take that first? You want?
Look, to me, the fact is that We have a Torah, okay? We have words. Words don't just give up their meaning, kind of, you know, there and then. All right? The kind of the meaning of words isn't a given that you can just say, oh, fine, all right? Yeah, we always have to interpret. We're always interpreting whatever we do. So the fact is that kind of whatever God says is at the mercy of mortal man as soon as it's written down in mortal man's language. So to be honest, that doesn't trouble me so much. In as much as, you know, we all know the interpretive gymnastics that kind of, you know, people go through when there are things that, with which they're uncomfortable within, you know, within Tanakh. We do it all the time. Number one, I don't think that what God means will ever come to us unmediated, such that we don't read it from our own perspective. So therefore, everything that God writes is mediated through mortal man in the first place. And number two, there are all kinds of difficulties in there that we interpret. Sometimes interpret away. Maybe that's my problem with humility, that I'm arrogant enough to think it's not a problem. But it doesn't actually, you know, genuinely is something that doesn't trouble me.
So I would just add, I think that that's, you know, one solution is to claim that you can never really know what God said, so you can never really, you're never really arguing with God directly. The other, I think, is that we have a magic word, which is basically an amulet that protects you against philosophy, which is kibiyachol, as if it were possible, right? So that if you read Tanakh, right, all sorts of things happen that are philosophically impossible. God changes his mind, right? You know, God learns. God, right, all sorts of things which, as a good Maimonidean, you know, is impossible. So the solution that we have come up with is we say we're not kibiyachol as if it were possible, and we'll leave that to the analytic philosophers, and we'll go on anyway, right? So I think that's fundamentally, you know, whatever Avram did at Stone. And whatever terrorists you come up with for how Avram did it at Stone, that's fine, right? Or Yonah, whatever they did, I'm doing. And I'm not, you know, and I haven't really worked out philosophically how I'm going to do it. If you'll tell me that I'm a kofir for thinking I can do it, I'll just say, I don't really mean it, I'm just doing it kibiyachol. It's a really cool word. It's a really, really cool word.
So we're short on time. I want to thank everyone for coming out to the second raft event of the semester. I want to thank Dr. Reinhold and Renee Clapper for making it and creating this great event. Tomorrow night, Dr. David Schatz, as Dr. Reinhold says, is speaking
flyers,
to the Skycat.
Yeah.
There's flyers in the front.
Other flyers here that Rebel sent me with.
Very good. And there's a sign-up sheet going around for the Center for Monitoring Leadership email list where you can get notifications of blog entries. And I'm sure Rebecca Clapper will love to tell you more about the Big Midrash and all the other programs. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much. Are you interested in continuing doing this in
Reading? Yeah, it'd be good to see you early. Certainly to kind of, you know, have it full make, I guess, and pre-make, kind of, a bit, kind of.
Alexander, what is this? Like a